no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a off.
He's listening to you.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging, mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I have high hopes for the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. This is episode 71. I'm your host, Alex Dixon. For today's show, we've got a gentleman who just in the last couple weeks won the Washington Post All-Met Coach of the Year for the spring, which is in the D.C. area, is when private high schools have their golf season. Public high schools have theirs in the fall. Justin Nogue was the head coach of the Stone Ridge Girls High School golf team. And he joins the podcast from Charleston, South Carolina, where he recently moved but continued to coach the team and plans to continue to do so, as he talks about in our conversation. I had a good time talking with Justin. He's a D.C. native, has got tons of roots in the area, and only just moved down to Charleston within the last year or so, again, as he talks about in our conversation. A couple notes on the conversation. One, Justin is also a former part owner of Peak Golf Fitness. Justin runs his own golf performance business in Charleston now called Elite Golf Performance USA. But Peak Golf Fitness here in the D.C. area comes up a bit, as Justin was a part owner there, and I was recently in there doing some work at Peak Golf, and Justin is still close with the owner, Jason, there, who I believe I'm going to have on the podcast as well in the next month or so. One more other note on the podcast. Pretty early on, he goes on kind of a 4 or 5 minute sidebar almost about what it's like being an assistant golf professional nowadays and kind of the issues that are in the industry. And it might come off as a little out of place in the podcast. And the reason that is, there's about 5 minutes or so that we had actually finished recording the podcast and we were just kind of talking and he started going into all these things. And so I took a portion of that piece of the conversation and kind of slid it back in when he first brought up being an assistant golf professional, which is fairly early on in the conversation. Just wanted to point that out. If it sounds like it's a little out of place in the conversation, that was why. But otherwise, a wide-ranging conversation. Really enjoyed getting to meet and chat with Justin Nogue, and he's got a lot of irons in the fire. So it was great having him on the podcast. Before we get to that conversation, a couple words from our sponsors. First off, Union Green Golf Balls. I've been playing their Pin Drop, which is their three-piece ball. I've been playing it now for, I don't know, a couple months. And Union Green also supplied golf balls to all the registrants at the Bankroll at Bretton Woods. But I've been using them, and I love them. You know, I don't really notice any drop-off from some of the higher-end ones. I mean, I've been a Pro V1X user for a long time, but I'm a mid handicap. Like, I lose golf balls like anybody, and my golf game's inconsistent, like a lot of people. And the reality is, at half the cost, I don't notice any loss on distance whatsoever. The ball spins well on my wedges. It grabs the green. It's a high trajectory ball. It's everything I need. I mean, I haven't noticed one negative, and it's half the price of all the super high end golf balls. So I am a big fan of Union Green. Obviously, they're a sponsor. Also, really like their message. They're all about public golf. They're all about municipal golf. They've got some of their staff literally on kind of a tour of municipal golf right now around the country. Follow them on social media at Union Green Golf on different social media channels. And you can kind of see some of the muni courses they are hitting throughout the country. But it's a brand I can get behind. They've got two different balls. They've got the aforementioned Pin Drop, but they've also got the T-Bird, which is a two-piece constructed ball for length. And right now they've got a deal on their website where if you buy any two pieces of apparel, shirt, a hat, two hats, whatever, they'll send you a dozen T-Bird balls. So that's quite a deal. So go check them out, uniongreen.com, social media at Union Green Golf on most social media channels. Give them a follow. They're supporting our podcast by supporting Union Green. You support Beltway Golfer. Also want to talk about Betway. This week is open week across the pond, our last major of the year. And it's a great week to download the Betway app and place a wager or two. Whoever you think is going to take home the Claret Jug. Want to place wagers and get in on the action for all your favorite sports, including golf? Betway has odds in over 1,000 markets while also offering incredible Betway boosts, including the one I'm going to talk about here just a little bit after this read, that they give me the green light to choose for the Open Championship as they have for all four majors. Register today and get up to $250 back in bonus bets with your first wager. All you need to do is sign up, make an initial deposit, and you'll be ready to bet with Betway. And if real money gaming isn't up your alley, you can take part in Betway's Big Pick Challenges instead. With this free-to-play game, players can make weekly picks on select markets with a cash prize of $5,000 to whoever gets a perfect score. Download the mobile app today and commence an incredible gaming experience. For real money wagering, visit betway.com/sports or download that Betway app. For the free-to-play game, visit betwaybigpick.com or download the Betway Big Pick mobile app. Please gamble responsibly. Must be 21 years or older to wager with real money. Terms and conditions apply. Now we're joined by Ellis Gore for the fourth time this year. Ellis from Betway, who has joined us for each major preview to make our picks. How's it going, Ellis?
Doing well, Alex. Thanks for having me again. Happy to be back.
This is the last major of the year, and the last time we were doing this for Betway, at least for this year, unless we decide to do an emergency one for the Ryder Cup, we'll see. But as of right now, it's just these four, and I need to make a move here. We still haven't. I'm going to tally these up in like a proper spreadsheet form, but we've been going over who our picks are, and first two, at least for me, first two majors of the year, my main pick were miscuts. Rory at the Masters, Cam Young at PGA Championship. But I did pick someone that made the cut, at least.
Congrats.
He was open. Victor Hovland, T19. You know, nothing that all that memorable. But I got a T20 out of my main pick. But again, I think you've beat me on the main pick each time. You had Cam Smith in the US Open, who at least had a proper showing at LA Country Club.
Hey, been getting lucky here. I think you finished solo fourth, so I'll take that any day.
You've had a few that came, a few top fives, and my other two at the U.S. Open, like so many people, I thought this was an obvious one. I thought this was going to be a slam dunk. The local kid, I took Max Homa, didn't make the cut. That was disappointing. And then I did get a backdoor top five, which I called top five, so I'm going to take credit for this one on the podcast. Tommy Fleetwood with the 63 on Sunday got a backdoor T5 at 9-1, and I put money on that. So I did win a couple books on that.
Well, considering, you know, you got some ground to make up, I will give you that one, and then we'll say we're even going into this final major. How's that?
All right. Well, we still got to tally up properly.
Okay. But
I know, unless I pick a winner here, I've probably lost in our head-to-head matchup here. All right, so this is, we're at Royal Liverpool Open Championship, last major of the year. I already picked Rory. I mean, I was going to say this immediately. We were just talking about this before we started recording. I already picked Rory early in the year, so I'm not going to pick him again. I picked him as my Betway boost in the Masters, and that obviously backfired when he didn't make the cut. But yeah, we were just talking about it. So he's coming off of a ridiculous win at the Scottish Open. He almost won at the Open last year, coming in second behind Cam Smith, and he won it the last time the Open was at Liverpool's. So, you know, you'd be silly not to throw a couple bucks on Rory.
I know. Yeah, that comes with a disclaimer. Always bet on Rory, Scotty, and Brooks, I think, in a major, at least a top five, you probably are going to do pretty well with that strategy last year or two.
It's amazing to say that for someone that hasn't won a major in 9 years.
I know, isn't it?
So who knows? Who knows? But, you know, what is he? Rory's at 6-1. But for my actual pick, I'll kick it off. For my actual pick, we're going to do the Betway boost, and right, you'll have to tell me what's boosted to. But I'm taking his runner-up. This one also makes sense. His runner-up from the last time the Open was at Liverpool. And who's back. Who's back in the winner's circles? Our boy Ricky, Ricky Fowler. He's coming right now at plus 2,000, so that's 20 to 1.
20 to 1, yeah.
So I like Ricky. I mean, he's having a hell of a year. Everything's trending his way. Why not?
Yeah, why not Ricky? I mean, he doesn't have a major, right? Wouldn't this be amazing if he got it this year after his epic comeback? And like you said, it's going to be boosted on the Betway Virginia app and website. 20 to 1 right now. It's going to get boosted to 23.5 to 1. So you're okay. Going to get good value on him as well.
Love it. I'm going to put some dollars on Ricky. So he's my main pick. I'm going Ricky Fowler in the top slot. Who you got?
Love it. Yeah, so my top slot is John Rahm. He's plus 1,200 right now, I believe. Honestly, he just kind of seems to be flying under the radar a little bit. He's clearly like one of the top three players in the world, but with Rory and Scotty just dominating the headlines, it seems like he's coming into this one, not under the radar, but I don't know. People haven't seen him get picked. And then I look at the, you know, Rory's, I think, 6 to 1, Scotty 6 to 1. Rahm's odds are double that. So I just figure, hey, when are you going to get a number like that on John Rahm, who's, I think, won 4 or 5 tournaments this season? So I'll go with
that's
John Rahm.
So he's a, what are you saying? He's at 12 to 1 right now?
Yeah. Yeah, plus 1,200. Getting him on a good number, I think.
That's great value. I'm not sure I fully digested that. I see it now, yeah. All right, for my second pick, and if you haven't heard this before, we take three picks each major. All three of mine this week are kind of that middle tier. I didn't pick any super long shots, but I didn't take any of the top 10, I don't think. So my next guy is going to be the, I would say hometown, but the national favorite, the Brit, Tommy Fleetwood, at plus 2,200. He's playing good golf. He's still looking for his first major. And you know what? I'm embarrassed to say I don't know if this is it's anywhere near if it's his home club or if it's near his home city or not. But I know it's his home country. He's been playing awesome golf, so that's good enough for me. He's due. He's been on leaderboards all year, and I like that value at 22 to 1.
Yeah, Tommy lad, love his golf swing too. It's like poetry to watch him hit the golf ball. Like, and he has been absolutely dominating this year. Or he hasn't gotten a win, but he's been all over the top 5, top 10s this year.
As good as you can be without a win.
Right. Great pick. My second one is going to be Dustin Johnson. Again, another one that kind of flying underneath the radar. He's 25 to 1. He's down kind of middle of the pack. He started off this season slow. Obviously, being on LIV Tour, he hasn't played a ton of events, but I think he finished top 10 at the US Open a couple weeks ago. He played well in the British Open last year, and you know, I think he played in the Open at Hoylake in 2014. I think he was top 10 or top 15 then too. So you know, I'm getting DJ at 25 to 1. I like the number too.
Okay,
yeah,
that's a good one. So so with the first LIV golfer.
Yep.
I'm not sure, because I'm about to throw out my third pick. I'm not sure I've picked a LIV golfer yet in any of my 12 picks, 3 picks for each major. And I'm not going to do it now. I'm picking with my third one. I'm going with another gentleman from east of the pond, Shane Lowry. I think he was one of your three for the U.S. Open, I think, or PGA Championship. He's a guy he's at 30 to 1 plus 3,000, and he's been playing good golf. And I don't think has he won anything this year? I'm not sure. But he's been on a bunch of leaderboards, and he played real well the last time. It was at Hoylake also. And, you know, he loves his links golf, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a home game for him. It's not in Ireland, but near enough. It's due east of Dublin, you know, latitudinally.
That's enough. I love Shane Lowry. I don't think he's got a win this year, but, of course, he's got an open win at Portrush, I think it was, when he that was a couple years ago. Yeah, and you're right, especially if the wind gets up there, he's like the type of player you want in those conditions. That's great.
That's my three. So I got all Ricky, Tommy, and Shane all between 21 and 30 to 1. Those are my three picks.
Okay, cool. You mentioned me picking a LIV player. I just want to add that we do have a market for will a LIV tour player win on the Betway Sportsbook. Currently plus 500 for a LIV tour winner, just for all your listeners out there. All right, my third pick, I'm going to go with the hometown kid, Danny McCarthy. I think one of us has picked him for every major this year and unfortunately hasn't gotten it done. But, I mean, he's playing, like, you know, we're not just picking him because he's the hometown kid. He's actually playing really well. And I don't think he's getting enough respect in on the lines. I see him at 80-1 right now. You know, maybe he doesn't win, but at that number, it's a great long shot. And if you like him for top 10 or top 20, I think that's good value there too. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm looking at him right now. He's plus 850, 8.5-1 for a top 10. It's a good bet.
I mean, yeah, I like it.
Okay. So 5-1 for a LIV golfer to win. That's an interesting one.
Absolutely.
Betway's got a lot of good, nice little props in there for these majors.
If you go into the Betway application, there's a category called hashtag bet your way. That's where we'll have all the prop bets, you know, holes in ones, LIV tour winners, wire to wire winners, things like that. So,
yeah, you can get lost in there. There's a lot of different options, a lot of different games you can play. This has been great. Well, this has been a lot of fun doing this with you, Alice. I think I'll post on social media once this is done, like kind of the review of our picks.
Love it.
From the four majors, but it's been a good time, and hopefully I can get a winner in one of my three. We'll see.
Best of luck. Thanks, Hodge.
All right. Have fun watching.
So let's get to our conversation now with Justin Nogay, the head girls golf coach at Stone Ridge and owner of Elite Golf Performance USA. Enjoy. Justin, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing real well. So let me start off by congratulating you on your recent All-Met Coach of the Year. That's a big achievement.
It was really cool. I had no idea actually until I got a text message from the Good Counsel golf coach who said, "Hey, congratulations on Coach of the Year." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" It's like, "You got Coach of the Year for All Met." I'm like, "Oh, no kidding." You know, it was really cool. I had no idea. I wasn't expecting anything, but it was really nice to see.
So nobody reaches out for the Washington Post and is like, "Hey, you did this," or you just literally have to, like, someone's got to let you know, or you got to read it in the paper.
I guess you have to read in the paper, because that's what I thought. I thought maybe they would let you know ahead of time or something like that. I'm not sure, but I believe the person who does it, I chatted with her and she came to the tournament that I host at the end of the year. So we chatted, we had a good conversation and told her a bunch of stuff about the event, about one of the girls. I nominated one of my girls for All Met who got it. She made first team, so that was great. But yeah, they don't really call you ahead of time or let you know.
That's pretty funny. So we're gonna talk about your team. I wanna hear about the tournament that you started, because it sounds like that certainly played a role in your winning the award. But you're talking to anybody that's kind of checking this out on YouTube versus just audio, you'll see your business name behind you on the wall there, Elite Golf Performance. So here's what's kind of interesting, kind of jumped out at me when I saw your name as Coach of the Year. You're not even living in DC anymore.
That is true. I don't live. I moved in October to Charleston, South Carolina. So I left the DC area, born and raised there too. Been there my whole life. So left the area, but still came back to coach.
So you're coming back up just for the golf team to do the coaching. How is that commute? Are you coming up for the week just for tournaments? Like, are you doing some coaching remote? How does that work?
So basically what I did was, first and foremost, my two assistant coaches that I had, I couldn't have done it without them because they were the best. They could fill in when I couldn't make it. But I would pick, basically, I went over the schedule and I picked, say, 2 or 3 days most of the weeks that I would come up, stay for 2 or 3 days, and come back. So 1 day or 2 days out of that week, one of the assistant coaches filled in. I tried to pick the dates that there were matches and things like that. But that's what I did. I drove every time, too. Drove up. Drove back down. I'll probably fly a little more next year. But plane tickets were expensive. So I just kind of said, drive. It's okay.
Any idea how many round trips you made in the car just for the season?
I think it was probably about 6 or 7.
Okay. I was in my head thinking a lot more. That's not too bad, but that's a lot.
Yeah, it was a short season, the way it worked out. And like, there was one week where they had spring break and then a really short week for Easter break. And I just said, okay, I won't come up then. I'll have 2 weeks at my facility because I still have clients here to train. And, sure. You know, being a one-man business, I guess you could say I eat what I kill. And so if I'm not training, I'm not making any money. So I had to balance it out perfectly. But my clients here were very understanding. They thought it was pretty cool. And I was happy to do it. I loved every minute of it.
Interesting. So how long you've been involved with the Stone Ridge Girls Golf Program?
Ever since they started it, which I think was roughly 2015 area, somewhere in there. One of the girls at Stone Ridge who played golf and trained at Peak Golf Fitness in Rockville, Maryland, when I was there, she asked Jason, the co-owner at the time, hey, can you coach? And then Jason asked me to be an assistant. I said, sure, yeah, that sounds fun. So we did it together, and then I stepped in as head coach eventually, and she left the program, but been there ever since. And it's been, I guess you'd say about 7-8 years with the program.
So you and Jason, who's the owner of Peak Golf Fitness here in Rockville, soon to be Ashburn, he was the head coach, you were the assistant. At the same time, you guys were both also running Peak Golf Fitness and kind of coaching Stone Ridge together?
Yeah, and at that time, initially to start, I was an assistant golf pro at Woodmont and Columbia Country Club too. So,
oh wow.
You know, as we moved down the years and years, Jason got really busy, Peak was getting busier, and then I stepped in at Peak as another owner, part owner. And so that's when I kind of took over. We could share more of the workload, but at the same time, he could focus more on Peak. And I was just really into the program and watching it build. So things worked out great. But yeah, me and Jason, we kind of got the ball rolling there.
The first thing that jumps out to me already is you got to be really good with time management. I mean, I know a lot of PGA golf pros have to be, even if you're just giving lessons at your club or you're employed, there's an element of eat what you kill and giving lessons to the members and such. So you kind of have to be your own business. But you just talked about kind of helping run Peak Golf, coaching a high school girls team, and you're an assistant pro at one of those clubs all simultaneously?
Yeah, I wasn't a co-owner of Peak until I left the assistant golf pro world. But okay. Nonetheless, yeah, I was still juggling a bunch of jobs at the same time. I had other independent training jobs too, so on and so forth. But, you know, I was young, and that's what you do. You work hard when you're young, and it is what it is. But, I mean, I know the golf industry isn't the friendliest for a lot of free time. I'll leave it at that to be nice about it. You could have a whole episode about that I can talk about a little bit. But nonetheless, not a ton of free time in that world. Everyone that had talent left because they're like, dude, I'm making no money and I'm working 7 days a week and 80-hour weeks and you won't allow me to give lessons unless I'm off and I'm still 80 hours in the shop. It's just, it's not a good lifestyle right now. And I wish there was a change to it, but I think it all starts with the head golf professionals and the directors of golf and creating that structure. And it's not all of them. There are some of them who do a great job. My sister worked at a course in South Carolina where they did 4 days of work and 3 days off. And I was like, you have got it made. But
is it because the mentality is just you gotta earn your stripes, you've gotta put in the years before you're paid properly kind of thing? And until then we're gonna grind you.
So that's how kind of it should be. And I get that, but that's kind of like saying, you know, well, I had it this bad when I was an assistant, but I personally want it better for assistants than I had it. And I wish that they kind of created that mentality of, you know what, no, we're gonna give people 1 to 2 days a week off, even in the season. And a buddy of mine just got a head pro job in the area, and I think he's doing a really good job of that as well. And I'm really happy for him in that regard. So there's some new blood kind of taking charge. And trust me, I am the first person in the world to say kids need to work harder. And when you're young, you need to work your butt off. But when you overkill it, that's where we have a problem. And like, we don't mind working weekends. I don't think anyone should complain about working Saturdays or Sundays. But when you work 30 straight days and you're expected to put a smile on your face and, you know, be the same and not be worn out, and you look at your paycheck, you're like, something's just not adding up here. So that's there was a big article in Golf Digest or something about a year ago about this whole saga. And it was the first time that.
I read that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was happy it came out because I've been talking about that for years. There's some things in it that are just, you know, not perfect right now, but I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful they can get the talent back and And just the memberships too, they need to be better with not expecting to see that assistant pro every single day. You know, it's just like them. You're off of work at certain times, so are assistants. So, you know, hopefully eventually we'll get in that. But until then, yeah, they're just losing a little bit of talent now, unfortunately. So once I left it and became a part owner of Peak, I actually had more time to kind of be flexible and make time for the team, so on and so forth.
So you've been involved with Stone Ridge High School Girls Golf Team in 2015. One of the things that was pointed out in kind of the little snippet with your All-Met selection as Coach of the Year was this golf tournament you started. So I don't put my foot in my mouth and misrepresent something. Why don't you tell us about why you started this, what the golf tournament is, why you started it, kind of the history of it.
Yeah. So when the Stone Ridge program started, there was very little private school girls golf traction. There wasn't much competition. There were no leagues for the girls in general. So essentially we didn't have anything to play for. And year after year went by, you play matches and it's like, all right, good season. And that's about it. But there was no trophy to play for, no conference title, no nothing. So I was just like, all right, let's do something about it. So I met with the AD in 2019 at Stone Ridge, who's been awesome, by the way. He is incredible. And I said, I want some conferences. I want to start a conference. And we and him talked, and we came to the idea, all right, let's start with this golf tournament. And then hopefully that leads into better participation amongst girls, private school golf, and then eventually conferences. So that tournament was designed just to give these girls something to play for. And it started out, and we didn't have our first year until 2022, last year, because of COVID and everything like that. But it worked out really well, and it got people interested in the game, and it's growing already from year one to two. And I just basically invite any private school girl in the DC area, more or less, to keep it simple. And you can be represented as just an individual or as a whole team. And so you compete for a team title and an individual title. It is two rounds, nine holes each round. And lowest score for the team and lowest score for individual wins.
Interesting. How many teams, how many private schools were women without country, so to speak, like didn't have a conference?
Individually, we had probably about 10 or so, I believe.
Interesting.
Players that didn't, because to make a team, you had to have three players minimum.
Okay.
It was count the best three scores out of your team. You could bring a maximum of five. So there were a couple schools that brought one, that brought two, that couldn't qualify for the team, but it was still awesome. And they were very gracious talking to me afterwards saying, hey, thanks so much for doing this. This was a lot of fun, but hopefully it gets interest in the program and they can build a team for the upcoming years.
Interesting. So 2 points of clarification. So these are all like private school girls, like all girl schools, not like, are they all necessarily co-ed or all not co-ed or some of them co-ed?
They can be either. So like Stone Ridge, all girls school, when I coach, but Good Counsel brought five girls and they're co-ed, and O'Connell brought five girls this past year. They have a team. So it doesn't matter. Usually the two conferences that we're mainly trying to target here are ISL conference and WCAC, and just trying to form leagues eventually. But in the meantime, you know, let's all compete, just the girls, because there was very little participation when I started. And I think there's enough demand that, you know, we can build programs and we can build conferences eventually. So this, I think, is just hopefully the start of building that.
Because I'm not sure I realize, and maybe others don't, that those schools didn't have women's golf programs before they started their own, the women's golf program. Was it the concept of if a girl wants to play golf, she would just join the boys' team, or a lot of these schools just not have, there just wasn't an option?
Yeah, they either didn't have an option or they had to play co-ed and make the co-ed team. There are no girls' conferences still. Now we have girls' teams at some schools, but there are still no conferences and whatnot. So yeah, if you're someone at, let's say, St. John's, and they had a girl participate this year, and it was awesome, but she also plays on the co-ed team. She plays with the boys, she plays in the WCAC, but there's no structure for all girls competition yet in the DC area private schools.
Even for other sports?
For other sports, there are, just for golf. Golf is
just for golf.
Behind.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So, okay. So you come up with this tournament in 2022. Where'd you have it?
So last year in 2022, the first round was at Northwest Park Inside Nine, and the second round was at Argyle Country Club.
And that's cool.
Argyle is where I was. I grew up at Argyle as a member. I was an assistant there, and the head pro's daughter went to Stone Ridge. So Kevin Taylor, he has been awesome with helping us host one round last year and this year, and I couldn't thank him enough for hosting that. And this past year, it was Brent Woods first rounds and then Argyle for round two. And so ideally, you probably want to make it one day, 18 holes. But with who you're dealing with right now and the level of competition at this moment, it's probably best that you just do nine holes. But we've got a great course in Brent Woods this year. And that was Ann Renninger at Holton Arms, the head coach, who helped get that. So it got better year two from year one.
Interesting. So like at Stone Ridge, so 2015, the program started, and that Stone Ridge is an all-girls school. Prior to 2015, just not enough interest in golf, not enough girls were, you know, they never had a golf team before 2015?
Not that I know of. Interesting. Yeah, wasn't any thought to it. I just don't think there was any demand. They might have had like one girl every now and then that was a golfer, but there was no program, so... You know, they just didn't do anything about it. And then finally they started out as club. Then we became varsity. And now we're trying to build an entire program.
Very cool. So the name of the tournament is what?
The Washington Metro Private School Girls Golf Invitational. It's a little bit long.
But that's all right. We can come up with an acronym or something. Is this starting to become the de facto end of season championship or kind of like final tournament?
For us, it certainly is. A couple teams play matches after the tournament, but, you know, that's what you play for, essentially, right now, if you're one of those all-girls schools. And my thought for the future was the boys. So I played at Georgetown Prep. So we had conferences in the IAC, and then the WCAC has their conference tournament. Well, the top two teams from each of those conferences played off in what's called Metros.
Yep.
And that was like winner take all, best team in the area. Let's find out. I want my tournament to become the Metros. I would prefer to have two separate conferences. We play that, take the top two from each, and then come to my tournament. And that's for the whole, you know, DC area title. So that's my ideal goal for it once there are conferences established. So it would be the final event of the year. But for now, it's just an end of the year tournament that there are trophies at stake, you could say.
Very cool. WCAC and IAC, do they have girls teams that also head up a playoff in the Metro finals today?
So they don't have, there are a few of them that have all girls teams, but that's just I don't know if it's co-ed or boys. I'm not sure, but girls are allowed to play if they can make the team. I'm not sure if they have to play from the boys tees. I don't know how that works in the WCAC, but
interesting. Yeah, there's got to be a lot of challenges that I can't even think about. Essentially, starting a program from scratch, and also creating a schedule where a lot of your competition is doing the same. And I imagine from year to year, the teams that you might be trying to play, you know, do we have enough players, recruiting players to play the sport? Is there a lot of that going on?
Yeah, I mean, well, now that there's, I guess, a program established, it's easier to recruit players or kind of persuade them, hey, we got a team, you're a golfer, great. But scheduling at the beginning in 2015 was like, we would call Bullis or Landon and say, hey, can your JV play against us? Like, we don't care if it's guys and girls, just guys, just girls, doesn't matter. We look for anything we could get. We're just trying to play matches, get competitive, and build our way up. And now there's more girls programs, so the scheduling shifted a little bit. But there are still some co-ed matches throughout the year. I always schedule Georgetown Prep JV against Stone Ridge just because I went to prep and the AD's been very kind to schedule a match every year. But yeah, it's co-ed, it's all boys teams, and it's all girls teams in our schedule.
Interesting. Now that you're down in Charleston, I mean, are you gonna be able to, is the plan to keep this up? Or are you going to try to pass the program off to somebody a little more local?
So my thought is I will try to stick with the program as long as I can until the conferences are officially established, or at least there's an ISL conference. That was kind of my main goal, is once we have an ISL conference, I'll feel comfortable and I'll pass the torch to whoever wants it, no problem. But until then, there's just something about it that I just feel obligated to keep going and keep going. There needs to be a voice just kind of saying, please, can we do this? Can we do this? Not that everyone else doesn't care, but mm-hmm. I feel like so far I've been the most vocal about making it happen.
Got it. What about getting course time? Has that been a challenge or as a new program or fairly easy based on you know your connections and everything in the golf world?
To be honest, ever since COVID, it's been really hard. Since golf right. has been so popular since COVID, private courses used to be great and very flexible and, you know, let us on. And now that their demand is so much higher and there's double the members at some clubs now or whatnot, it's a lot harder. And they just, you know, they want to help, but they're just so busy that they can't do as big of a favors anymore. So we can get some Monday course time at some private clubs. But weekdays, like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, it's tough. So believe it or not, we make Sligo Creek. Basically, you could call it our home course in a way. It's 10 minutes away. It's affordable. It's a great club. The guys there are awesome to us. So we've kind of made that like our unofficial home club.
I gave that little fist pump because I have nothing but love for Sligo Creek. That was the first golf course I ever played. I love Sligo Creek. So it's a fun little nine-holer.
It is, and it's perfect for the girls, too, and it's perfect for girls' matches. It's not too long. There's no par fives. You get around in like two hours, 10 minutes. It actually works out really good.
That's pretty cool. I got to ask, I think you're the first, I'm trying to think, unless there's somebody I haven't thought of. I've had one other Georgetown Prep golfer on this podcast who recently has only almost gotten his first one on PGA Tour a few times, Mr. Denny McCarthy. And I think
had
I
had my buddy Denny on there.
He was on here. I had him on right after the Wells Fargo last year. So maybe a couple weeks after that. But I remember, I think I
grew up together.
Oh, you did. So were you on the team at Georgetown Prep about the same time?
Yeah. So I was a senior when he was a freshman, but we grew up at Argyle Country Club together ever since we were, I don't know, 7, 8 years old. So
oh, wow,
we were in
cool.
just like a group of guys and yeah, we grew up playing golf together and it was interesting because his brother is my age and he went to Gonzaga and it was interesting when Denny chose Georgetown Prep and not Gonzaga like his brother. That was funny. I didn't expect that, but it was awesome having him on the team for that 1 year. It was really, really cool. He won the IEC title his freshman year,
that's as a freshman, that's pretty impressive. I mean, I would imagine golf in the IEC is you know nothing to sneeze at.
No, it's pretty good. Unfortunately, that year, guess who got second place?
Okay. Do you remember the margin? Was it pretty close or?
He got me by like two or three. I mean, he's just so good. So he's always had that something special about him. But it was a lot of fun. I couldn't have been happier for him. I was like, this kid's going places, and I've known it for a while. But it was a fun time, fun experience. Some of my best times are high school golf. And that's, again, another kind of reason why I'm focused on building a program is some of my best memories of golf in general are from my high school days.
Well, speaking of that, and I actually brought that up, Georgetown Prep, not to go on a Denny tangent, but more I was curious about, because I grew up fairly close to Georgetown Prep, went to public school, but the golf course there. I was curious if your ties there, because how many holes are left at Georgetown Prep now? There's not many. Was it five or seven or something?
Okay, so this is what happened. It used to wrap around the whole campus and be nine holes.
Right.
So they took that out, and they just had that one piece of land now that the golf course is on.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, it is nine holes, but you loop around twice. So one time you loop around, you play from a certain tee box and you go to this green. You play a couple holes, and then when you come back around, you would tee off kind of from the same spot, but you would go to the other green. So there is a way to make it nine holes. They logistically figured that out pretty well, but it is a little confusing when you look at it.
How many greens are left there?
I think they have... One, two, three, four. I think they have like seven or eight greens.
Oh, they do. Okay.
Yeah. So when you play the same green twice, you're teeing off from a totally different spot the second time around, kind of thing.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. I keep meaning to go over there and kind of walk around the course, but one of these days. I hear it's actually not that if you can get past the guard, nobody really cares if you drop a couple golf balls in the course. I don't know if that's true, but.
Yeah, just as long as no one's really around and no one sees you. Yeah, you should be, because you can kind of uncover yourself over that mound. You know, you can kind of hide.
But the girls of Stone Ridge haven't. That's not in your rota of courses you play.
We play there every year when prep hosts us, the JV match.
Oh, you do.
Our varsity against their JV team. Yeah, we do it at Georgetown Prep every single year, and it's been awesome.
Oh, interesting. So it's also still in like kind of good enough shape that they can host tournaments. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, their JV uses it all the time. I don't remember the varsity using it really ever. It was there when I was a junior. They first opened it again when I was a junior. I think we had one varsity match on it the entire time.
So I'd love to kind of get talk a little bit about, you know, what you're doing now. I mean, we can talk a little bit about your backstory, but kind of leading up to your day job, so to speak. But so you played college golf at Towson. Do I have that right? Or what was your journey there?
I played 2 years at Mount St. Mary's, and then I transferred to Towson with the hope of walking on. Unfortunately, I didn't know at the time that when I emailed the coach, he would have said the roster's full. I'm sorry. So I didn't really have a chance to walk on there, but it's
okay. That's a bummer.
Yeah, it all works out, you know, found other things to do and whatnot. But sure. That was my total journey and been trying to stay competitive ever since.
And then did you go through the PGA program, or you just started working at clubs, kind of working your way up, or what was your kind of journey in starting to work as a pro at courses?
I started at Argyle Country Club, and you go through the PGA program while you're there. You can also go to college for it, but I didn't do it that way. I did it the other way, where while you're an assistant somewhere, you go through the certification and whatnot. So started there. And then got certified after, you know, it takes a year to 3 years, depending on how fast you do the work. But got certified in about a year, and then just started giving lessons, stuck with the fitness stuff as well, because that's my degree is exercise science. And then in touch with Jason, who had been in touch with me for years at Peak Golf Fitness. And that's when I started getting a little familiar with the biomechanics, the 3D analysis, all that fun stuff. So I just stuck with everything. I never really picked one in particular that I was focused on. I loved it all, and I loved how they all correlated with each other and whatnot. So ever since then, I've just been obsessed with all of those.
Interesting. Okay. Because what we're going to get at to is kind of your time at Peak, but your business today, which is Elite Golf Performance based in Charleston, where you're at. But so, and you, when we spoke on the phone, you know, those two businesses, now they're in different locations, but kind of the same. You know, same type of business. You're doing the same thing for your clients, which is all about fitness and performance and the body and the biomechanics. So you just said you majored that in school. Was that kind of always the plan? Was this is what I want to study to help make golfers better, or that just came later?
It came a little later. Like I was a political science major for 2 years. And then I learned what politics is more about, and I left immediately. So, you know, I thought I would be the fitness guy. And then all of a sudden I became obsessed with the golf swing as well. And then I got introduced to the 3D, and I'm like, well, this is really cool. I've never seen this. And then I got really nerding into that. And I've been into all of it. And I love talking about how the body connects to the swing, how movement in the 3D shows how someone moves and creates power in their golf swing, and all of it relates to each other. And there's a reason we do all three. And it's just really cool throughout the past years, just learning and learning and learning more.
This whole kind of world of, you know, golf fitness, you know, it's been around for a while now, but it seems to, with the technology, it seems to be changing rapidly. Did you kind of first get, you know, did you go through some kind of like TPI training early on, or because of what you studied in school, that was not necessary?
No, it was necessary. TPI, the certification there, definitely got certified, and it's a little bit different for sure. And it's invaluable information. I think the information from TPI is so good. It teaches you kind of how the team approach works in golf, the swing instructor, the fitness coach, the medical professional, all that. Unfortunately, it's just now it's a little bit easy to get certified. I hate to say that, but the information I think is the best in the business. So yeah, I had to learn, and I honestly learned most of my stuff from hands-on learning. College did something. It did something for me, but I learned most of what I know today from from other trainers liking some of the things they did, hating some of the things they did, and just teaching myself throughout the way and going through, honestly, a lot of failures. Like, as a young trainer, you do so many things you look back on, and you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. That was so stupid. But that's how you learn.
Can you give me an example? Because when one is an aside, I went through a TPI, like the 16-point TPI assessment on the podcast. This was like a couple years ago, even before I met Jason at Peak, with a gentleman named Casey Edwards, who is now he was working out of a facility in Reston, and now he's I can't remember his title, but he's basically at Congressional doing this type of work on the staff at Congressional, but. The reason I bring that up is he put me through, we did the podcast, we kind of had a talk, and then I just put a camera, didn't even put much thought into it. I just had a camera on the ground and filmed him going through the assessment. And truth be told, you know, I'm already old and overweight and out of shape, but I think I was a little hungover that day when we actually did it. So it wasn't pretty, but I put it on YouTube along with all my other podcasts, and that video has like, you know, 10, if not more, X more views than any of my podcasts. And I only bring that up because there's clearly immense interest in this field. And there's people out there searching it on YouTube or Googling it. And so kind of my long-winded roundabout question for you is, one of the things that Jason at Peak told me when I first went in there was, you know, TPI is kind of a 16-point assessment. And he was like right off the bat, like, we've got 33 different things we're going to kind of test you on. And so my question for you, since you know, in the same world, you know, TPI is kind of, you know, the industry standard. It's been going for a long time. You know, what does TPI miss? Like, what are some things that, like, for instance, you work on at Elite, when a new client comes to you to look at, you know, what their baseline is?
So TBI sets a really, really good baseline. And I think they made it just very simple and straightforward of like, these are the main points to test someone. There are specialized tests that they have that once you become like a medical professional or a fitness professional and specialize, they add more tests. So it's just that initial screen that everyone does in level one, which they just kind of keep it simple. But throughout the years, you know, you as a trainer pick up on certain things like, you know, okay, this guy failed the internal rotation test and this and that, but he does these two exercises really, really well and he shouldn't have. What can I do to find that out sooner, kind of thing? You start just thinking of all these different ways to test people. And so you create some on your own. You learn from other trainers and you get a little bit more specific based on what you personally believe is most important in diagnosing someone's physical limitations. So, you know, whether it's their deep squat test or whether you think a deep squat test is worthless, I test internal rotation in the hip now in two separate ways instead of one, how TPI does it. And I just developed that through years of trial and error. So there's so many ways you can go with things. And unfortunately, there's no right answer. And there's no way to really prove a right answer because you can't tell me you improved on X because of Y. There's so many other variables. Nothing's causational. So it's really just kind of up for interpretation and what someone truly believes is most important. But yeah, there's a lot more tests out there and every trainer has his kind of set way of doing things and then just adapt from that. But I think TPI deserves a lot of credit for creating at least like a fundamental baseline of where to start and where to begin so that even the golf coach that knows nothing about fitness can do this assessment with a client.
So what does your assessment look like today if I'm a new client, if I walked into Elite tomorrow, how many kind of things are you testing on me and how much time are we spending together?
So my total analysis is probably about 90 minutes. So we get you on the 3D machines. I do that first. And then while we're doing that, we talk about everything about your golf game. I want more information than you could ever give me. Any piece of info is going to help me diagnose, okay, what's truly the root cause of all your issues that you're having? Where should we start from? So I need every bit and piece of information about your misses, this and that. Do the 3D, do a 2D video, and then we do the physical assessment, which we're going to test your movements like TPI does. And then I added a few in there that I personally like. And then we do some power tests. So we test power like TPI does. I use the TPI ones, a vertical jump, chest pass, sit-up pro and rotational pros. And that gives me a very good general baseline of, okay, he moves like this, and his power numbers say this, so he should be capable of producing, you know, roughly X amount of speed. Let's see what it actually is, kind of thing.
Interesting. What about, because the technology has changed so much. Are you, when I first went into peak golf, within 10 minutes, I was hooked up to, you know.
Yep, the sensors.
The sensors that were, I don't know how many Jason put on me, but it was a lot all over my body. Is yours similar? How are you using technology to kind of figure out how a client's body is moving?
Yeah, so I used not the exact same 3D he has, but it's very, very similar. And okay. So that to me is, I use that more for programming than anything the physical assessment says. I learn more about someone through a 3D analysis personally than any other test I do. And so it's going to essentially say, how do you move in your golf swing? Where do you produce your power? Where do you lose power? Where might you be at risk for injury? Where inefficiencies in your golf swing? Essentially, what you can't see with the naked eye, the 3D can tell you. And so I use that as most of my program building. And it's funny enough, because to me, it's the only system that really tells us there are two things that are almost universal with tour players that they all do the same. They all do two things the same that 3D can pick up on: transition sequence and peak speed sequence. Nothing else picks that up. So they do two things identical, universally. And so why wouldn't I use a piece of data that says, hey, you move like the best players in the world, or you don't? Okay, let's find out why you don't, and let's get you to move like them.
Let's go through those two things again. The first one, say it one more time.
So transition sequence.
Okay. So transition sequence, and you're going to correct me here, but I think I know what that is. I mean, that's pretty soon. You know, the sequence of how you're transitioning from your backswing to your downswing. Is that right?
Yeah. And, so it's a proper sequence. We're measuring.
Okay.
So we're measuring. We take that from, we measure your hips, your torso, your lead arm, and either your hand or the club head. Those are the four things we measure, and there's a certain order we need to initiate the downswing in with those body parts.
When people are talking about the sequencing in the golf swing, what's the second? So the second thing is the one I was like, I kind of, it gave me pause. Like, what do you mean by that?
So at what point in the golf swing does each of those body parts we're measuring, the hips, the torso, the lead arm, and either the hand or the club head, at what point in the downswing does each of those reach their max speed?
Uh-huh.
So the hips should reach their max speed first, then their torso, then their arm, then their hand. The best analogy I can give for why that matters, think about maximum power output. So if I were to snap a towel,
mm-hmm.
versus hit you just completely accelerating the towel, which one's going to hurt more?
Snapping.
Probably the towel snap.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens? Something accelerates. My arm accelerates. Then it decelerates. And then all that energy from that arm goes into the wrist. Then the wrist accelerates. And then it decelerates. And all that energy from the wrist now goes into the end of the towel. That's what's happening in the kinetic chain in the body, in the golf swing with the best players in the world. So imagine trying to snap a towel where you accelerate your wrist first, then you throw your arm, and then the towel snaps. That's not going to be nearly as powerful, right? That's going to be weird. Right. But that's what's happening in most amateur golf swings, is things aren't reaching their max speed in that sequential order. So, of course, they're not going to get maximum power output. And it's also going to feel a lot more violent to them versus the guys who move best in the world. It's kind of what I call effortless power. So it's a lot simpler. It's a lot less stress, and it's just more flow and kind of that whip that they create in their golf swing.
And creating that whip, I mean, how much of creating that whip and that proper sequence and the proper, I'm gonna phrase it wrong, even though you just told me, but the maximizing or the proper sequence and when you're hitting that max speed in each part of your body, how much of that is, you know, just proper swing technique versus you know, flexibility and strength in your body. Like, how, you know, in my, you know, if someone were just to ask me without having a conversation about it, I would think it's more, you know, you're just your swing technique and a swing coach. But I'm guessing you're going to tell me something different as you know, someone who's talking about biomechanics. And am I right?
Well, the thing is, there's a couple reasons or a few reasons that someone probably sequences the way they do and peak speed sequences the way they do. There's a couple reasons I can think of. And one is, yeah, it's just that's your pattern. That's how you swing the golf club. But also, what could be causing you to sequence the way you do? Because it could it be a physical limitation that's causing you to start the downswing with your arm? Like, do you have right ankle mobility problems that you can't store energy in your right leg in the backswing so you won't fire off it, blah, 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 blah? Or is it simply just you're putting yourself in your backswing in a position that if you did sequence properly, you would hurt yourself? Something like that. So there are many reasons why someone could be sequencing the way they do. And that's where it's my job to figure out, well, why is he sequencing that way? Is it a golf coach thing? Is it a fitness thing? Is it, you know, a backswing position? I don't know. And that's what I got to find out when you come in for your analysis.
Interesting. One of the things you had mentioned, is it challenging? You had mentioned on our first phone call that nowadays, you, not only do you have clients that come into your business, but, you know, like, swing coaching, online swing coaching, like, you know, all these different apps and all these different, whether it's through, you know, Instagram or whatever, has blown up in the last 5 years with technology. Can you kind of do the same with what you're doing with, you know, when you're analyzing body movement and fitness and stretching and all that? Is it just as easy to do remote, or is that more challenging?
It's so I still have the mindset of, you know, being a nerd and trying to read how someone's body works. But online, I just don't have the sensors, so I can't say anything definitively. However, yeah, like right now I'm on the Skillist app where someone can sign up for a lesson and they send me videos and I give a whole analysis and give them drills to do. And I try to pick out, and I've kind of caught a little bit of an eye for some biomechanical issues that could be happening, but I'm not 100% sure without the sensors on them. But there are some areas that I'm like, I would guess that, you know, your hips aren't driving here first, or, you know, I would guess that you're late peaking order. I can maybe sometimes make an educated guess, but I can't ever tell definitively for sure unless you actually get on the system and I see it in front of me.
And just so people make sure people heard that right, the Skillit staff, how to spell that? Skillit?
EST. At the end. Skillist.
Oh, Skillist.
Yeah.
Got it.
So it's you're really on. Good. And I think online instruction is actually, there's some benefit versus in person. Personally, I believe sometimes in person is better for sure. But the online portion lets you give someone kind of a drill. And also, it allows them to, if they like sign up for an unlimited monthly package or something, they can go to the range, they can be doing the drill I want them to do, and they can take a video of it and say, hey, how does this look? And I just, you know, look at it and I respond, hey, it looks great. Just make sure your right elbow is a little more whatever. But they can get constant feedback from that versus the in-person. Like, you just get your hour and then you got to drill all that on your own and you got to hope you're drilling it correctly. Right. So that's why I think online coaching for some people can be a huge, huge benefit in some cases.
When folks, your clients, I'm just kind of curious, what percentage of how they can improve from a physical standpoint is a total lack of flexibility, or another way to put that is, you know, more stretching, like a proper stretching routine that they're doing on a daily basis, whether it's before a round of golf or even on days when they're not playing golf, so they can just become more flexible and, you know, have a wider range of motion and all, and just move better versus, you know, some more technical sequencing and what you're talking about.
So you and maybe most others won't like the answer that I personally believe in, but I think stretching is at least a little bit, if not a lot of it, overrated. I really, really do. I think stretching is very overblown. I can't tell you how many clients come in and say, yeah, I just need some good stretches. And I'm like, okay, but what's really going on? I honestly think people are weaker than they are inflexible. And so, yes, you do need mobility. You 100% need mobility. But I'd argue I get better hip mobility out of someone by teaching them how to properly deep squat with maybe even a weight in their hand versus, you know, touching their toes or whatever it is, stretching wise. I'd prefer to strengthen you and stretch you. I think I get more out of full range of motion strength exercises for flexibility purposes. So I know that's not the answer people like to hear, but I think now there's this conventional thought of, oh, I must need more flexibility. I'm definitely tight. Well, is it, are you tight or is it, are you weak? I don't know. We're going to find out. And a lot of people, unfortunately, I would argue, yeah, we'll do a couple mobility things, but honestly, you're just really weak. And through some strength training, through full range of motion exercises, you're going to pick up more flexibility that way.
Interesting. The strengthening exercise that you put your clients through that are golf specific are probably, unless you grew up playing competitive golf, a lot of them are, might be new to you. You know, like I, you know, when I'm not hitting the gym, my workout consists of a bunch of push-ups. That's which probably doesn't help my golf swing very much.
But you do need push strength. You do need it. It's funny because golf is full of, on social media and where you see, you know, these golf fitness exercises. It's a lot of what I call accessory exercises, which are, they're necessary, they're good. But quite honestly, I think more people would benefit from sticking with some of the basics. And they're the basics for a reason, because they work. So I would say everyone listening that wants to do something, do some type of squat, do some type of push, do some type of pull, do something where you rotate, and do something where you hip hinge. If you can go with those five basics, you're going to at least see progressions and improve. I would argue that's more important than anything, because I don't really care about your shoulder mobility if you can't do two push-ups. I think we got bigger fish to fry here.
Right. And when you say hip hinge, like kind of like touching your toes kind of thing, or what do you mean by hip hinge?
So it's, if you kind of look up Romanian deadlift, that's
okay,
how
sure.
you hinge from your hips. A lot of people don't know how to hip hinge properly. So, you know, half the time I'm teaching them how to hip hinge before they're allowed to pick up weight here. But nonetheless, like a lot of what I do, especially with the kids and whatnot, it is general, what you would maybe see in other, you know, athletic workouts. It's a type of squat, or it's a split squat. It's pull-ups or a lat pull down. There's another side of that, of course, where, you know, we got to activate certain muscles. We need to learn how to stabilize our hips and rotate our torso. We need to learn how to separate lower body from upper body. There's a bunch of that. But there are those basics that we always, always touch up on. Because again, I could care less what your shoulder mobility is or hip mobility is if you literally can't do two squats or two push-ups. I think you need to gain the strength first, and right, then we can build that up. But I think it's not as confusing as people think. I think on social media, we always see these cool exercises. Those are accessory ones, like the Golf Forever stuff with Scottie Scheffler. Scottie Scheffler is doing a lot more intense stuff. They're just not showing it because it doesn't look as cool. But he's doing trap bar, you know, deadlifts. He's doing some intense stuff for strength training. It just doesn't look as cool as him with that band, you know, doing rotations and all that fun stuff. So it is part of golf training, but I think we've lost sight of the basics. And just one other caveat, if anyone ever sees something that says, fix your early extension with this exercise, or, you know, learn to do this in your golf swing with this exercise, just don't watch it. You're not going to fix anything in your golf swing with an exercise. You might be capable of fixing something, and that's what we do. We make you capable of doing X, Y, and Z in your golf swing, but there is no direct correlation to, oh, well, if I just do this exercise, I'm going to stay in my posture better now.
Right, right. How has it been? So you, refresh my memory, you went down to Charleston to start Elite Golf, and how long ago?
In October of 2022.
Okay, so not even a year ago.
Not even a year. We're brand new.
Charleston's a big golf town. There's some great, I know there's great golf courses down there. I'd imagine it's a big golf population. Was any businesses like that in Charleston before you opened up?
Not really. And that's why I came down here. I just noticed there was a void down here, and I'm like, are you kidding me? Charleston's got, you know, it's a wealthy area for the most part, and there's a lot of golf down here. And yeah, I think there's one other really specific golf trainer down here who's pretty good, but no one really does the 3D and no one has a setup like this. So, you know, I figured, hey, this is an opportunity and there's a really good market for this down here, I think. And so far it's been pretty nice with the clientele base so far, and word's getting out and everything, but I'm happy with where the business is at so far.
One, my question is, what is the reason aside from a 14-year-old kid who's trying to play, you know, he's already a good golfer and is trying to get a Division I scholarship, like someone a little older, because I'm asking this from a selfish point of view as somebody who's if I'm not already, and most people would say I am, I'm quickly getting over the hill, and arguably, you know, that happened many years ago, but like, what is the most common issue, you know, when a mid to high handicapper comes in or you talk to, whether it's at your business or not, that you feel is kind of holding them back from a physical standpoint?
Yeah, no, I think there's certain areas that people just fail on the screen all the time. It's like 90% plus, and people don't know how to activate their glutes. They have them. They're there. They just don't know how to use them or turn them on. And it's very easy to do. You just need a week or two of doing the right exercise with the right cueing. But that's number one. Number two is the inner core muscle, the transverse abs. They don't know how to use that. They don't even know where it is, what it is. There's a muscle deep inside your six pack. That's the guy we really want to turn on. That's your big stabilizer. It's deeper inside of the six pack. So unfortunately, we don't care about the six pack in golf at all. But we can, a lot of times people get reduced lower back pain if they get the transverse working properly. And a lot of times it is a stabilizer. So that means if you were limited in shoulder rotation, sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes if that transverse can stabilize you better, you can get more shoulder turn just because your body is programmed better now. So that's one of the benefits to those two areas that are universally failed. And then the pelvic tilt. Everyone should learn how to pelvic tilt. It's very simple. It's like the cats and dogs type exercise that people see in yoga all the time. Please just learn how to do that. That's like a prerequisite for so many exercises and so many things I do. And it'll reduce your lower back pain, maybe. Maybe not.
Can you sometimes it's challenging on an audio podcast when we're talking about very physical things that you have to watch, but yeah. You know, we'll Google that, but like, can you describe what that is and how it helps you?
The pelvic tilt is essentially, picture your pelvis. It's that big bone in your hip area, and picture that pelvis, the whole bone. So you can also picture your belt buckle to make it easy. Picture your belt buckle rotating down and pointing more towards the floor, and then picture kind of rolling the hips up and kind of tucking your belly button into your spine, and the belt buckle would be then pointed more up towards the sky. That is a pelvic tilt. And the reason it matters, why we care, number one, I think it helps activate your transverse abs better if you can pelvic tilt. Number two, it reduces back pain sometimes. And then number three, TPI makes this claim as well, and I agree with it besides one caveat, but you're not going to be able to produce ground force effectively in your golf swing if you cannot pelvic tilt. So that's a really cool one that people don't realize, because in the golf swing, if you are utilizing the ground for power in your golf swing, you have to be posteriorly tilted in your pelvis on your way through. So that's when you kind of would tuck in your belly button and have the belt buckle point more towards the sky. You have to do that in order to use the ground. And the only way around it is everyone's least favorite golf characteristic is the early extension, the thrust. That's right. The only way, in my opinion, to avoid it. You can still use the ground technically, but you're thrusting, so we lost power anyway. But the pelvic tilt, get your glutes activated, and your inner core muscle. If you can do those three, the only two I would add on is learn how to separate your lower and upper body. Learn how to move them independently of one another. If you could focus on that 5 minutes a day, just one exercise touching on each, you will be so much better off and more capable of doing what you want in the golf swing.
What about, is there anything, any tips you can give? Because you kind of already gave your hot take on stretching, you know, yeah. on the day, let's talk about like on the day of a golf round. Like whether, you know, a couple hours before the round or 15 minutes before you start, you know, you start your round, aside from the or maybe there are the stretches. I'm just kind of curious, what do you do before or around now that you have all this information?
So what you should do is you should do either a dynamic warm-up, which dynamic is just think of like doing shoulder circles. You know, think of Michael Phelps when he goes in the pool before he swims. He does that thing flapping his arms around. He's doing a dynamic movement. So that's going to train you for the activity you're about to perform. You're going to lengthen your muscles and shorten your muscles in a very short amount of time. So it has to be dynamic. The one thing to avoid would be what static stretching is, which is think of a toe touch and just pausing and holding a toe touch for like 20 seconds. Don't do that before you go play. All you're doing is lengthening a muscle and weakening it. So it's not very functional to what you're about to do on the golf course. You're actually more at risk to get injured, and it decreases your power output, believe it or not. So
interesting. That's what I'm going to blame my double bogeys this morning at Worthington Manor was because I did that exact thing on the range this morning.
And you can do toe touches, but make them dynamic. So go down, exhale on your way down, and then come right back up and do it like reps. Just do, you know, 6 or 8 reps of toe touches and make it dynamic versus just going down, pausing and holding. But I would say with dynamic movements, create them. Like, I don't think there's a universal protocol for a warm-up. Just move. Do some deep squats. Do some lunges. Take your golf club and turn your torso as much as you can left and right. Anything at all to get you moving. And then I would recommend those three that I talked about just a while ago is do some bridges to get your glutes fired up. Do your inner core exercise and do some pelvic tilts. If you can spend, you know, even 2 or 3 minutes warming up, not only getting loose, but engaging the muscles you want to use, you'll be ready to go. You won't need to hit balls. You will, but you won't need to. You would feel a lot better on the first tee if you just had to step right up.
Do you think there's benefit in doing this? You don't really see many of, I mean, you see some, a little bit of stretching if they're waiting, but like on tour or anything like that. Do you think you see any benefit during a round to doing some of this? You know,
I think if you're riding in a cart, yeah. If you're walking, I think everything's moving and I think it's okay. It's just kind of being stagnant for an elongated period of time. That's what's going to maybe get you tightened up again or feel tight. But it's not the most necessary thing in the world unless you personally feel like something's different or, you know, I tightened up in my hips, it feels like, or something like that. Yeah, you could do some stuff on the course, but it doesn't seem like it's the most needed area. You just more or less need to be warmed up because you're still doing that violent motion every now and then. So that's enough to keep your body going.
Interesting. Have you put a lot of videos? I know we've brought up Peak Golf a few times in this podcast, but I did notice that a lot of the videos of Peak Golf that they have online are still you.
That's right. During the whole COVID lockdown, I literally just went into the business every day and made us our online platform with all the exercises, explanations, everything. So, yeah, they still use those videos to this day, and I'm glad they do. I still continue to make them and whatnot, but that was during that whole COVID lockdown. I got that whole process started and just built us that entire platform at the time. You see it all over social media now, Peak or Elite Golf Performance. You see those videos out there.
Very cool. So we can find a lot of those. I would think there's a lot of folks. I mean, I get the idea of golfers that once they get their kids out of the house, maybe you know, they got some extra time, they got some extra money, they can kind of focus on their golf games and winning that club championship. But there's got to be so much of it. I mean, I've seen this. I mean, I'm 45 years old, and my handicap has been going in the wrong direction for a variety of reasons. I got young kids, but just busy doing stuff. But also, just as you know, as you get into your 40s. You know, your body stops doing the, you know, it stops listening to you in a lot of different ways, in part because bad habits have piled up, but also just because with aging. I would think golfers in their early 40s, you know, this kind of thing would just be huge for, because this is when you need it.
Yeah, and it only takes, believe it or not, it only takes, you know, 10 minutes 2 times a week. I settle for that, and I'm fine with that. That'll still leave you some room for improvement. It doesn't take all this equipment. I know everyone has 10 minutes 2 times a week, no matter how busy people are. I get it. And that's where I've learned in the past to compromise a little bit and say, all right, 10 minutes 2 times a week, this is what you're going to do. Because you're going to move. We got to keep you moving. And at least this way, you can maybe progress a little bit, but at least you're not going to go downhill. And that's all it takes to get started, because I wouldn't recommend anyone get started and just build up an hour program and expect to do that. That's, you're going to fall off of it most likely after a week. You're just not going to have the time. You got busy. Yeah. But if you set yourself up for the bare minimum at first and just say, all right, 10 minutes in-home workout twice a week. Yeah, you can do that. And then once you can do that, it becomes a structure. It becomes part of your week. Every Monday and every Thursday at, you know, 9 a.m. or 4 p.m. or 8 p.m., that's when I do it. And once you have the structure, you're off and running. You're all set to go. But you have to create that foundation first and make it a part of your routine versus, you know, in your mind, something that, oh, yeah, I got to find the time to work out. And make it a part of you, and it only has to be 10 minutes twice a week. And then after you do that a bunch of times, yeah, you can build up from that. You can make it 15, you can make it 20. But to start out, it doesn't take a lot. And that's what I think scares people away. They think they need to be doing hour, 2 hour workouts. And no, you can be in your living room for 10 minutes. I promise you, we'll get you someplace with that, at least to start.
I feel like you're talking right to me, because this is what I need. I need to create the time. I have the time. I got to stop scrolling through social media and get on the floor and do some of this stuff. Very cool. How has, I think the girls of Stone Ridge are probably pretty lucky to have not just a coach who's you know, taking the initiative to start tournaments and help them organize a better schedule, but also is kind of an expert in everything that you do. How much of this kind of mobility and strength training and fitness is part of girls' golf practice at Stone Ridge?
It's not as much as I would love. when we started out in 2015, and so we were kind of with that mindset of like, oh, we're gonna be able to give them instruction and we're going to do fitness and this and that. We did a little bit, but you also have to learn who you're dealing with. And a lot of these girls, this is not their main focus. On our team right now, we do have two girls that I think golf is like, that's their sport. That's their thing. One of the girls is really, really good. But other than that, they do this for fun and they want to enjoy it. So I learned in the hard way that, you know, sometimes they don't want instruction. They'll ask me for help a little on the course and stuff like that. They'll say, what club do I hit? And I'm like, well, I don't know. You tell me. it's minor. It's not as much as you would think, but there's a reason for that. We kind of learned the hard way that they're not there for just strictly instruction. They're there to enjoy themselves and just be part of a community that we've built. So a little bit of swing instruction when they want it. I always offer it. I say, anytime you girls want, just let me know. I'll be happy to, you know, give you a lesson and whatnot. It's just not taken advantage of a ton. But again, it's totally fine. I enjoy doing it. I love doing it. And, you know, we do have a couple of girls now that take it more seriously. So I did get a little more involved this past year with one or two of them.
Why don't you give us your website and maybe a social media handle where people can find you?
Yeah. So EliteGolfPerformanceUSA.com and EliteGolfPerformanceUSA is Instagram. You can also search me on Twitter. It's Elite Golf SC. Elite Golf Performance was taken, I guess. But if you search Elite Golf Performance on Twitter, you can find me as well. I'm always, you know, if anyone ever ventures down in the Charleston world, I'm happy to help them out.
I think a lot of people do from DC. It seems to be kind of a next step of, I mean, obviously people emigrate all over the country from DC, but when you've been in DC too long, Charleston always seems like a nice option. That I know so many people that have moved to Charleston from DC. It's crazy. Well, listen, congratulations on the move. Best of luck on coming up on a year of your business, and certainly congratulations on winning All Met Coach of the Year here this spring in the Washington Post. Big honor.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me on.
I don't have a good golf game, but I don't really care. I'm a regular dude living in D.C., and I want to know about D.C.-centric golf stuff. If you can tell me something that I don't already know, then that is great for me. I don't want the regular stuff. I want exciting stuff. I want different stuff. I want stuff I can't hear elsewhere. But I want it to be about D.C. golf.